Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Well, happy Monday and welcome to another information-packed edition of Global Leader Radio. And today I take great pride and pleasure in introducing this week's guest, Keith Schroeder. Keith Schroeder is a 2010 graduate of the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University and the CEO of High Road Craft Ice Cream. It's a gentleman that has actually taken his culinary prowess into the laboratory, and he crafts some great tasting ice cream, gelato, sorbet, all the things I can actually eat, well, with the exception of the ice cream. And so, and he's doing some great things across the board. And we'd love to hear a little bit more about what he's doing and what his take is on leadership from a global perspective as well as domestic. So, Keith, how are you, sir?
I cannot be better. Life is good.
I always like to hear that life is good. So great to see you here with us today, and great that you're taking a little time out of your very busy schedule to join us.
My pleasure.
So knowing that that you're incredibly passionate about what you do, and especially in how you produce results, can you help make us a little bit more familiar with your personal background?
Sure, sure. I was born and raised in Long Island, New York. I grew up on the South Shore. So those who are familiar with Blue Point oysters will be able to throw a rock at where I come from. So I used to hang out on the beach as a kid, and I became very passionate about food. I was a big fan of the sea and seafood growing up as a kid, and stumbled into a career as a chef after actually a career in an emerging career in broadcasting. I was a college radio kid. Okay. I was really into the punk rock, the rock and roll, the heavy metal.
I can see that. I can see some of that.
Spent a lot of my time in my early 20s doing college radio up in Oswego, New York, which is where I did my early undergrad, and I was a broadcast communications major.
What is actually your degree in? I mean, it's not
my undergrad degree
in
business management and communications.
Okay, got it. And communications. Okay, so take us a little bit further through that. So we've gotten you through business communications. So now you actually went to the Art Institute of Atlanta. Right?
I did. I came down here in 94. The Olympics were coming to town, and there were jobs aplenty, unlike today's climate
there.
But you could get a job by breathing back in the day, so that was phenomenal. And I was an eager culinary student, and I had my first significant culinary experience down at the Atlanta Hilton and Towers, and was lucky enough to work my way up to become a rounds cook at Nikolai's Roof. And at the time, that was the place to be in the city, and I just learned a ton and worked under some very intense and very passionate chefs up in that restaurant.
In the Riviera restaurant as well, right?
Riviera, yeah, I was a glutton for punishment. I worked for all the notorious tough guys, the guys that made Gordon Ramsay seem gentle.
I'll bet. So now you were not working at these places together?
No, sort of in sequence.
Okay.
Yeah, I and most cooks work their way through, you know, spend a year one place, move on, learn at the next, and you know, a good handful of chefs also end up traveling and working their way around the country just to get some perspective on cuisines and different people in different cities.
Interesting. And so then, and that's what you did. You took your skills on the road and you went to several top kitchens in New York, San Diego, L.A. Can you continue to fill us in?
Sure, sure. I ended up in New York City. I worked for a catering company called Table Tales back in the day. It was a really wonderful place, and we were catering to, you know, Martha Stewart, Hugo Boss, a lot of the big financial firms down on in the Wall Street area, and you know, money was aplenty again during those times. So we really got to do some beautiful things, and to live and work in Manhattan is just an amazing experience as a culinary professional. From there, right after 9/11 and the tragedy that took place there, I moved my family up to Burlington, Vermont, and became the executive chef at New England Culinary Institute. So I tried my hand on that, educating young emerging chefs, and had a great time doing that. Thereafter, was recruited to start a culinary program out in San Diego at a large gaming venue out there called Barona Valley Ranch Resort and Casino. And served as an adjunct culinary instructor at Grossmont Community College out in Southern California, and grew a big culinary department over there at the casino.
And that had to be a great experience.
Oh, sure. And then headed over to Los Angeles, where I was the executive chef of the Sheraton Los Angeles. That was a monstrous 1,000-room hotel.
Wow.
And then had a good time avoiding sleep for a couple years there, and then found my way back to Atlanta, Georgia. Was a task force chef for a number of hotel companies, and then found my way to KSU.
Yeah, interestingly enough, you finished your executive MBA at the Coase College of Business in 2010, a little after the time that I actually came on in 2009. You had already started in 08, obviously.
That's right.
Okay, and so, and you did that well. You did pretty strong in that particular program because you did earn Beta Gamma Sigma honors.
I did.
So how does a chef who maintains that high level of performance then take that and move it into the classroom as a student, learning something far and wider than just the culinary arts? Now you've gone from the art side to more of the quantitative side with regard to school. So there must have been a reason that drove you to want to understand a little bit more about business.
Sure, without a doubt. You know, one of the things that you have to do as a chef as you work your way through the ranks is you have to master P&L management. You have to be exquisite at it, actually, to survive in your job. Large hotel companies manage strictly to those P&Ls. You know, margins are important.
And every little bit counts.
Flow through a dollar is important. Management of labor is important. And while I had a handle on it, I felt like I had middle management skills, and okay. I wanted executive skills. And that's what led me to KSU. And the teaming component of it was really the thing that drew me on. Because as a chef, you know, from the age of roughly 21 till the age of 36, I hadn't seen a human being except for a line cook, a prep cook, waiters, waitresses. I mean, you're 24/7. And so while you network with other people as guests of your dining establishment, you don't really develop intimate relationships with people from the outside world. So to a large degree, I felt like I lived in a bubble.
Ah.
And so, you know, it was great to have someone who was, for instance, a Marine fighter pilot on my team, and someone who worked in accounting software sales, and someone who was an environmental engineer, and someone who worked for the state, you know. All I ever knew from those folks was, how was your steak, man?
Well, because this is internet radio, Keith, I tell you. That of course, some of those steaks that you prepare were probably pretty good, I must say. But we do want to make sure that the folks that listen to our broadcast know that Kennesaw State University's Executive MBA program is a lot different than any other program out there in the fact that we do teams from start to stop. In other words, teams are composed of people that are, you know, 5, 6, 7 person teams, and they come from a variety of backgrounds, very diverse across the board.
That's
and
right.
They are in this domestic intact team for the whole length of their program, correct?
Without a doubt. And I will say from my personal perspective that I would not have been half as willing to start up a small business where we're tackling the big boys like Haagen-Dazs and Ben and Jerry's. But I don't know that I would have learned half as much had we not had those weekly meetings, those phone calls till 2 o'clock in the morning where we were trying to unearth the answers to many of the problems posed to us during the course of the program. So,
storming sessions as well.
Yeah,
because it's all
course.
Part of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, the conflict, you know, was built into it. And I think by the end of the program, you realize that, you know, built into the game, so to speak, so you learn to step back a little bit and take things a little bit less seriously. And I think that's also part of being a good business person, too, is to learn how to not let everything get to you.
That's right. It's not all that important.
That's right.
And sometimes even when it is important, it's not all that serious, right? So one of the things that you did when you were in the executive MBA program, of course, you don't have a choice in our program. You, as a team, you have to come up with an idea that is pursued in the fifth semester, an entrepreneurial venture. Can you tell us a bit more about what your team? First of all, what was your team's name?
We were Team Oxygen.
Team Oxygen. And it was chosen because?
We had 8 on the team, and I believe the the periodic elements number for oxygen was 8. And we were stretching. We were ready to jump in the lake when we were coming up with a name. It wasn't one that really resonated with anybody's soul. We're just like, we need to go inside. The name is Oxygen. Let's go. So the efficient decision making, but it ended up working out for us well in the end. So relative to the business idea, we had a couple business ideas as part of our program, and that was getting late into the program. And had a great buddy of mine, Adam Hayes, who's an environmental engineer by trade and had a fairly technically complex business idea that I think everybody looked at themselves and said, I don't think our brains are actually prepared for anything technically complex in addition to the business plan that we have to do. And was my founding business partner, Hunter Thornton, who was on the team, said, why don't we do Keith's ice cream idea? And everyone slapped the table in 5 minutes. Everyone was drinking a beer and said, done. Ice cream
vote,
sounds
right.
Like fun. And so you seeing the pattern on our team of quick and rapid decision making.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. So while you were there, you and your partner, Hunter Thornton, won the 2010 International New Ventures Competition at the University of Nebraska. What was that like?
It was incredible. And I credit Professor Gary Roberts with encouraging us to pursue the business further. Had it not been for him and his belief in the clarity of our business plan, I don't know that we would have taken it anywhere, you know, and that's another testament to the engagement that the folks at Kennesaw had in us. We were recommended to Dr. Charles Hofer by Gary Roberts, who didn't take us that seriously at first because we had a silly ice cream idea, and most of the businesses that he coached were trying to cure cancer and save the world. So he's like, another ice cream company. What's interesting about that? Mm-hmm. And as we went on and described the business model, it was something that Dr. Hofer not only started to believe in, but got behind us, and we ended up entered in a number of business plan competitions. So the International New Ventures Competition in Nebraska was one of the serious ones and one of the competitions that would grant you entry into Global Moot Corp competition if you win that one. So we got there, and there were folks from, I believe, MIT was there.
All the big folks, right?
All the big folks. Carnegie Mellon. You know, we pulled up from Kennesaw State University. People had elaborate trade show booths. We had a laptop. And, you know, I think we were the only folks who weren't full-time, you know, students. So these folks were well-geared to be in there. And we showed up sort of impromptu on the fly. We had our jobs, our families, our wives, our children. And we thought, oh, we're dead meat. And then we went through a series of iterations of the pitch to various venture capitalists, business judges there, and we kept winning them over with the clarity of our business plan. And I think given the down economy, even the judges were looking for a business plan that they could believe in, and ours was concise, right? The idea was, we sell ice cream to chefs. Well, how do you know that chefs will buy a product? Well, I'm a chef, right? So that's
that's how I can
right?
tell you.
And then they said, well, explain further. And I would say, well, let me pose a challenge to you. Call Häagen-Dazs right now and tell them that you would like a chocolate ginger ice cream on Thursday night and you only need 10 gallons.
Nothing.
And it was fall on deaf ears. I said, okay, now tell me another local company, local ice cream shop, somebody who could do the same thing by Thursday.
Nothing. Wow.
And so the answer, you know, it became pretty simple. And then I knew we were doing well when the focus of the conversation started teetering, like, the name High Road, how did you come up with that? I'm not sure I like the name. I'm like, we're going to win this thing. Because all we're talking about is
the esoteric stuff, right? You've won them over with the other stuff. So now you have led your company into a rapid growth sequence now. So I actually did see it on the shelves over at Whole Foods Market. I showed my wife about a couple of months ago, and she was amazed. She said, these folks came out of your program, right? I said, yeah. So where else other than Whole Foods are you featured today?
We are in all of the Fresh Market stores nationwide.
Nationwide.
We are in all of the Harris Teeter stores nationwide. We are in a handful of Dean and DeLuca stores. We are available online. And I'm very proud to say that our teams worked hard together, that we are now the featured ice cream at the buffet at Caesar's Palace.
Very nice. Very nice. And all that from a little school just northwest of Atlanta.
We'll take it.
Well, it works. It works for me as well. And now you've also been featured in several publications. So can you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, we've been lucky. We've ended up in Cooking Light magazine and Southern Living magazine. We've been in a number of newspapers. We've ended up on, we've been on television a couple of times and continue to get press. All credit for that goes to my wife, Nikki Schroeder, who has a phenomenal background in design and marketing, and has her graduate degree from SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design. So we put some tuition dollars in the Atlanta economy.
And that's what I'm talking about. So now Nikki is also a very astute judge of talent because she actually chose you and married you. So that's she's pretty good. She's pretty good. I'm sure she may even be listening to the show today. So tell us a little bit about what is it about great food that, in your opinion, contributes to a life well lived?
I think, and this is exactly why the business exists. I think that the exchange of food, the sharing of food, is one of the things you do every day, and that is essential to a life lived with civility. There are very few outside of the eighth grade cafeteria fights at the table, and I think that it's a place where you can exchange culture, language, flavors, and get to know people, their languages, and we have such a global team at High Road. We have people from Morocco, from Thailand, from Nigeria, and that diverse population that exists within the four walls of High Road helps become the fabric of the inspiration behind all of the flavor. So people talk all the time about how creative we seem to be. And I try to contrast that. I say there's really not a lot of creativity going on here at High Road. It's more of an awareness, okay, right, and an honoring of culture. So people will say, oh, your mango chili lime, that's very creative. Well, not so. It's something that would be very common on the streets of, Tijuana, Mexico, for instance. Our Aztec chocolate. Everything is inspired by somewhere and someone, and that's what we're seeking to do with the company.
So that's where the global influence comes in,
it.
Right?
We're just trying to honor people.
Okay, and you're doing it very well. And so your bio says you're a dedicated and unconventional leader. I'm hearing a little bit of it because I hear a little bit about the rock background.
Yep.
and enjoying yourself and being a family man and really looking at the larger things in life and civility and a life well lived. So tell us and the listeners why you chose those adjectives to describe you.
Well, I was the kid who spent time as both a football player, a wrestler, a track guy, right, but was also heading over to practice for the student play.
Okay.
That was going on. I'd be the kid that got abused for singing a song on my way to wrestling practice, and I couldn't get myself aligned with any of the groups. You're a jock, no, you're a theater nerd, and so I always sort of rode the line between these groups of people. So I found myself in sort of social limbo over the course of my earlier years. And I think I have a father who's a football coach, a stepdad who's a CPA, and there are just a lot of mixed signals coming my way as a young man who and it certainly made me live a life with a very independent mind, and develop a level of self-confidence and gravitate toward the things that simply I enjoyed to do. And I think that it's a life well lived when you fight for things worth fighting for. And typically that centers on people.
Yeah, yeah.
And
good point.
And so within our environment, particularly in food, you find a lot of underprivileged folks who end up finding themselves washing dishes in a hotel, for instance. And I've developed a passion for helping people like that find their brilliance. Right.
Okay.
So rather than hiring for pedigree, we're just looking for something completely different. It's a character thread, some thread of hope, some magic in a human being. And then we dig in really deep. And I think there's a lot of tough love involved in the leadership at iRoad. You know, people take a look at our company all the time and say, your place looks like a very fun place to work, Keith. And I said, we've done a very good job on Facebook and Twitter, though. because if you sit down and talk with the folks, they will tell you that it is an intense life experience.
It's performance-based, right?
For sure. It's all about merit.
Yeah, and if you can't do it well, then nobody eats.
That's
not good when you're in the food business, right?
That's it.
Yeah, that's not good at all. So how do you know when you're talking with a leader?
They listen.
Okay.
End of story. I look back to my father. My father had my high school football field named after him, you know, and he was always the guy who showed up at the game and stood back in the wings and just observed, right? And he gathered his notes and he gathered his feedback and then would go offer any feedback as a measure of help for his people, you know, and showing up at his retirement dinner, I guess it was roughly a decade ago now, was a magical experience because you saw these people get up on the stage and talk about how much my father had facilitated their success. And that's what he did for folks. My mom's an amazing human being, too, in that regard. She's a director of medical records at a hospital on Long Island and is just, by the very nature of what she does, of service to people every single day. And she thinks about, you know, the line item details of whether or not a particular medication or condition is spelled right, because it could mean that someone gets killed if it's not on there the right way. And so, you know, from my mother, I get the detail orientation. So get those edges right, dot all the I's and cross all the T's. And from my father, I think, you know, you get the gift of observation.
So it's truly a yin and a yang which comes together, right?
For sure.
And that's what makes the dedicated portion of the dedicated and unconventional.
For sure.
Okay. Oh, I like that. So when you think through your culinary background, I know that you mentioned several leadership lessons you've learned from both your parents, but what are some of the leadership lessons you've learned from your culinary background, having gotten to where you are today?
Sure. Well, in the early, and this is something I struggle with to this day, because I think that you hear a lot of folks saying that the days of managing with intensity should be over. You know, it's 2012. I had people saying that stuff in 1996, too. Well, it's 1996. You don't talk to people like that. And I'm sure people in 1986 said, it's 1986. You don't talk to people like that. And I'm telling you that sometimes it's necessary to talk to people like that.
Yeah.
And when you balance it with, you know, emotional engagement and their well-being with this sort of visceral passion for them to get it right, I think you end up getting license to be tough as nails. And I think that that's actually missing from the country. I think it's missing from business, this idea that we should all be, you know, soft and you know, fully have this fully confident executive presence sometimes masks the reality of what's going on in front of us. I'm sure people at AIG were all very, very professional.
When the bottom fell out, right? Probably not. Yeah, interestingly enough, a few weeks ago we had on Anna Stevens on from EQ for Success. She was on with Keith Holmes, who was who's an SVP with AT&T. And interestingly, she was talking about, you know, the fact that you, the emotional quotient or EI portion of an emotion intelligence that you're very familiar with from our program, you know, sometimes suggests something a little softer than what it truly is. I mean, this means being empathetic, but it doesn't mean being soft totally. It does mean getting the point across, making sure that you're communicating and making sure that the sender is understanding and getting what the receiver should be getting and vice versa, right?
Absolutely.
There needs to be some commonality between the message.
Sure, and I think a leader looks to his people and should look to their success outside the confines of their business. So if I'm looking at one of my employees who has suggested that they want to be a math teacher, what he needs to understand in order for me to operate with tough love is I care more about you becoming a math teacher than I care about you carrying boxes of ice cream correctly. And if we can create this beautiful cycle of success, I'm sure someone will float in right behind you
right
to carry boxes of ice cream. But you have to go be a math teacher. You know,
That's right.
We're doing something here with this business.
That's right. It's important, right?
It's critical.
Because you're making leaders. So if you were to look to find your successor in your role tomorrow, what three attributes would you say are critical success factors?
Well, I had the luck of having taken the Harrison assessment. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Harrison assessment.
Please tell our listeners.
It's it's a predictive behavior test that a lot of major corporations use to leverage for hiring decisions. And I took it, and I sat down with a gentleman and a lady who helped me investigate the depths of my mind and how I behave. And
sometimes it's a scary world right?
It was alarming. But one of the interesting things I found out about myself is that I spend an inordinate amount of time analyzing pitfalls. And I think if you are an aggressive startup, rapid growth company that's trying to take on big companies, you have to recognize that the majority of what you're going to encounter are pitfalls. And so they have to be able to look at all those little details and all the areas that you can trip along the way and be prepared with A, B, C, and D contingency plans, without a doubt.
Okay. So be prepared is the first thing.
And then the second thing is you have to absolutely unequivocally live with enthusiasm. If the people at the business don't see a natural propensity to represent the brand, the company, the people, the product with all of your might, they're not going to dig in and carry it with you. Okay. You know, one of my employees said to me the other day, these people wouldn't work this hard for anybody else. You know, and it was a sobering and humbling moment to go home and go, I have to make sure that I am thankful because these people are sometimes giving it every last drop, you know. And so I think that's important that you have to be genuine in that regard and thankful for what you have in terms of the people who show up every day and make it happen. You know, I'm not making ice cream right now. I'm talking to you.
That's right. That's right.
And and then I think lastly, you have to be innovating. If you're not creating, and it may not be a new idea, but it may be a twist on a new idea, or you know, if you're not observing the market and creating opportunities. I think a lot of companies are out there looking for trends. I think to a large degree that's a mistake. You might create a decent product that hits the market for a while and fades away, but I think you need to create trends. I think you need to be ahead of it. So we don't spend a tremendous amount of time looking at food trends, but we do look at things like what are emerging immigrant populations in the United States.
Yeah. So what you're doing is you're actually blending things together, correct?
That's
you're
right.
Taking it from different disciplines and coming together in food and celebrating it there.
Yeah, analogies, anything that you can synthesize into something that seems to make sense may be marketable.
Okay, and so that's the difference, right? That's what makes you so unconventional because you're looking at it from through a different prism.
That's right.
Okay, so we've got prepared. Certainly, you've got to be enthusiastic in your mind, and innovative are critical success factors. But if I were to add the fourth, and I'd love you to comment on this, must a leader also be competent?
Oh, without fail.
Okay.
Without fail. But only at a few things,
okay.
Right? And one of them would be courage. Courage to stand in what you don't know.
Okay.
And I think that that's honest, right? And honesty, I think, leads to competency.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Please show me what that is. You know, 90% of what I know today about the ice cream industry, I knew zero of the day we turned the keys and opened the door.
Okay. So you don't have to know everything.
Mm-mm. You just have to be ready to live in that world and field the unknown for your people.
Okay. Okay.
And guide and facilitate that. I think you have to be a competent facilitator.
And I think that, and I'll love you to comment on this, I call it tolerance for ambiguity.
Oh.
And so when you get involved in a program like ours, and again, it's preaching to the choir for you, but certainly the people on, you know, that are listening to this broadcast, the point is that becoming more educated actually does expand your horizons with respect to tolerance for ambiguity, because you will not know everything, because if you did, you wouldn't need us, correct?
Without a doubt. And, I mean, you know, we took some pretty advanced statistics, and I feel like I know less about statistics today than ever before. We learned all about the time value of money, but I would never assert myself to calculate IRR for any of my colleagues. But I know that I need to know it, mm-hmm. right? I know it exists. And I think that is, you know, an MBA provides you such an amazing array of resources to tap into when you need them.
When you need them.
When you need them.
And that's not just the resources, the human resources, because you certainly have that as well. Mm-hmm. Your graduating class was how large?
I think roughly 60.
60, yeah. And so when you look back at what you're doing today, what do you wish someone had told you before you started High Road Craft Ice Cream?
That is a great question. You know, I guess it would have centered around capitalizing the business and being ambitious to trust ourselves. When we started High Road, we had the idea that at this point in time, 2 years down the road, we would be, you know, roughly $1 million company, and we would be servicing primarily restaurants in the Atlanta area, maybe branching out a little bit to the southeast. I wish someone would have said, go be really, really ambitious.
Just go for it.
Go, right?
The big, hairy, audacious goal.
All the way. And we stepped into it so sensibly that when growth slapped us upside the head, we all looked at each other like,
do I have to?
Yeah.
Can I go a little slower?
It's going to be hard.
So I know we've invited you to come and speak to opening residencies in the past, and you've accepted invitations to speak to cohorts of our students at our executive MBA program at KSU. So what's the main theme you think is really important for those people considering not only our unique program, but perhaps personal development overall?
Right. It is to step out all the way into the unknown. I think a lot of people approach an MBA program. I was an unconventional student. I'm a chef by trade.
Correct.
So to step into that world was felt very scary, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. And I think that fear that I had fueled me to perform and to catch up with all those other folks who had more traditional business experience. I think that there's this perception that you need to know something specific going into an MBA program. I just think you have to be prepared for battle,
right?
For learning, and prepared for humbling moments. You know, mm-hmm. I remember answering a question, and I forget, it was the Scottish gentleman who teaches at KSU.
The Scottish gentleman.
He was had a lot of international business experience.
Dr. Doug Moody.
Okay, so Doug Moody. I raised my hand in class and apparently gave a wrong answer to something, and he stopped in his tracks and stared right at me, and the whole class shifted their head to me, and he said, well, that's a new one. And I had decided in my mind that for the next couple of weeks I was not going to speak. And you just have to be ready for that. And when it's all said and done, those are some of the most beautiful memories from the program. You learn a lot about yourself.
Yeah, that is true. So the main thing you're saying, so what's most important is that you've got to be vulnerable. You've got to be open.
That's it.
And you've got to be ready to just step into it and don't hold back.
Right. And there is no, I don't even think there's an advantage to having any prior knowledge going into it, because people are trying to teach you stuff from a different angle and from a different perspective. So even if you are an accomplished director of human resources, or if you're a very skilled accountant, it's really meaningless going into the accounting program, because there's a dialogue between, you know, 50, 60 students.
That's correct.
A handful of professors. And I will reiterate that it's always a handful of professors. It's not just a professor who's teaching the course who's hanging out in the room there, right?
That's correct.
Professors interact with one another, pose questions. It is a very unique model, and one I'm glad I pursued.
So when we look at your story, certainly it is unique, but I think I was struck, just to make sure I've got it correctly, you are from the Long Island area, mm-hmm. and your parents are still there?
Yeah, my mother is moving down the next month or so. I'm glad to see her retired now. So
okay.
Good stuff. But yeah, my dad's still up there in Long Island.
So the point is that it seems to be, do you have any siblings?
I do.
Okay.
I have three sisters and one younger brother from my father's second marriage.
Okay, yeah. So other than you, who else has moved on from that area? Because it sounds like you've embraced change enough that you've moved around the country.
For sure.
Where your parents were basically stationary where they grew up.
Yep, yep. Well, a lot of it's about a 50-50 split right now.
Okay.
In the family, yeah. My wife's side of the family has all since moved down from upstate New York down this way. So we've got a lot of change-embracing folks in the family.
So, and the ability to embrace change is one of the things I think that great leaders have the ability to do.
Well, and realize that really change is the only constant.
The only constant. Yeah, because, change is certainly one of those things that we can embrace or not embrace, but it is inevitable.
For sure.
Okay? It is growth that is optional, right?
Growth is optional, and there's a rhythm to things. I tell folks at High Road every day, we can step back now and be more profitable.
Okay.
Or we can keep standing on the razor blade and just go for it and keep going for it. And we had a meeting this morning, and I was mimicking failure as a character. Mm-hmm. And I got nose to nose with my wife, and everyone was laughing. I said, failure often comes up and stares me in the face like a big bully, and he flicks my nose, and he tries to stare me down and bully me out of continuing, but it's not happening.
Okay, good. So are you saying that leaders are introspective when you say that they step back and you need to step back and become more profitable? Can you talk a little bit more about that whole piece of it?
Sure. You have to reflect on, a lot of folks talk about vision, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's okay to have a vision, without a doubt. But the vision expands for you when you're open-minded to your business. I had a vision for High Road, and that vision was being the best ice cream company for chefs that we could possibly be. But the marketplace opened up those opportunities, and if my vision stayed, be the ice cream company for chefs, be the ice cream company for chefs, we would have missed all kinds of opportunities. So you have to pull yourself out of the business. You have to look at what the marketplace is saying it wants out of you, your brand, your product line.
Mm-hmm.
And things emerge. We never thought we'd be selling ice cream to casinos in Las Vegas in 2012.
Interestingly enough, you are one of the few executive chefs I remember coming through our program. Why is it we can't get more people that have that background?
I was thinking about the process or the phenomenon of inertia, right? I think chefs just get going, mm-hmm. and they get working those 100-hour weeks, and then one day the wheels burn out, and they're in their 50s, and the knees are giving up, and if they haven't been monstrously successful, those latter years are usually pretty melancholy for a chef. It's a strange profession to get into because it is, it's a young person's profession. You do better when you're 28 years old on your feet for 16 hours a day than you do when you're 58.
Yeah.
And so, I saw my kids growing up and time was a ticking, but I think that, there aren't a lot of people who engage chefs on the ascent.
Okay.
And they don't catch themselves. And a lot of chefs are dreamers, right? So they're trying to get there. They're trying to win the prize. They're trying to become celebrities. They're trying to get their own restaurant. But such a small fraction of us do. And I think having two growing children helped humble me a little bit and said, let me think about what's next now.
Mm-hmm.
I showed up at KSU at that interview and made my decision rapidly. It just felt right.
Okay. Well, good. So what are the three things that we can take away from your story and perhaps leverage in our own lives?
Boy, that's a tough one because of late the company and me have been getting recognized for having, a good product, some measure of success. But for me, I feel like more of a student than ever before, right? I've just ramped up the degree of difficulty in my life. So I think if that's a lesson, if you're sitting there waiting for something to happen, is not. It's simply not. Just ramp up the degree of difficulty in your life and more things will start to happen for you. Go tackle bigger challenges and feel pain. You know, stretch your brain, stretch your mind, stretch your body, whatever is required for you to generate a little bit of momentum. The momentum created in my life just by making the decision to get my MBA was huge. I read articles all the time, our MBA is useless now, and I think these people are fools. They're fools. No, it's the furthest thing from useless.
Yeah, they don't get it.
Yeah, no. And I think the other thing is, you know, you have to be able to laugh at yourself, and you have to be able to willing to face the prospect of failure. You know, I've had a tremendous amount of professional stumbles over the course of my life, but all of them have led me to be a more confident entrepreneur. And so I think you have to almost anticipate failure. And then I love Bill Belichick always says, we win because we lose fast. You know, I love that statement. Lose, fail, you're done. All right, you lost. Big deal. What's tomorrow?
Yeah, move on.
Yeah.
Right?
And then, and I think lastly, you know, you really do have to live in service to others. I mean, I don't think that life rewards the greedy person. I just don't. And while business may exist for a profit motive, I think that you have to be looking at profitability for all your people, all the stakeholders in your business, from your shareholders. And when they're greedy, you have to call them on it.
Right.
You're a greedy shareholder, and let them know. And they're like, I've invested in you. I don't care. You're a greedy shareholder, right? Or, you know, a greedy employee. Oh, I want to take a break. Well, no one else is taking a break, right? And create some parity in that environment. So I guess those are three things that I would say are certainly lessons learned and folks can take away from my experience.
So ramp up the degree of difficulty, go after it, face the prospect of failure, and live in service to others.
That's it.
Three great lessons. So I heard you mention this once before, and I thought I'd ask you a little bit more about this pointedly. Are you an entrepreneur who happens to be an executive chef, or are you an executive chef that happens to be partially an entrepreneur? And is there a difference?
I think that I am a student of human behavior that happens to think that business is the best path to changing the world.
Okay.
I think that government is bureaucratic, so it doesn't suit a guy like me. I think that education is next on my list and something that is the noblest of professions. But I think that business is powerful in this world. And if you want to be able to send a powerful message, then there is no better avenue to get into than business.
Okay, very good. So we've heard a lot about what you where your passions lie, but what are you most passionate about?
I am most passionate about unlocking human potential. I do not like to experience, whether it's my wife or my children, my mother or my friends, employees. I don't like to see people stuck. I see magic in a lot of people, and I think that it's when people don't see magic in themselves, it fuels me to kind of hold the mirror up to them and say, you know, you have magic too.
So it takes a little while before you can kind of see that, but after you see it, then you want to make sure that they see it as well.
Oh, I've become the biggest pain in the butt in America. I'll pick at them until they get it right.
So this is Global Leader Radio, and we are spending a little time with Keith Schroeder, the CEO of High Road Craft Ice Cream, and a graduate, 2010 graduate of our executive MBA program. Dare I say one of our finest and most accomplished students, sir.
Thank you.
So if there was only one characteristic of a leader to talk about today, what would it be for the entrepreneurial world, in your opinion?
Tenacity.
Tenacity.
And that comes from Dr. Brock. Help Dr. Stephen Brock help bring that word to the forefront of my life. And that I think that as you reflect on any challenge, you know, and you say, if I apply a certain measure of tenacity to this, will the result be better than it is now? And the answer is unequivocally yes, right? So if you are tenacious, stubborn, tough, you'll win.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Dr. Brock is certainly one of my mentors and recently retired from the KSU Executive MBA program. And he actually was one of the folks, along with Debbie Roebuck, that coined our coaching model. And we use the acronym ACT, Awareness, Choice, and Tenacity. Yeah. So you give of your time and talent by serving, I'm sure, in numerous capacities and service to the community. Can you tell us a little bit about what those are?
Sure.
And perhaps what you've learned about yourself through that servant leadership aspect.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things to do every day, and I discipline myself to do it. And I don't even know if I get credit as a volunteer for this because it is so much fun. But I coach youth football for the Lassiter Trojans youth football program. And it is just a joyful experience. I've been coaching football for about 6 years now. And, you know, I play the role of silent observer on the field. I am the absolute inverse of what I am in the business place. I think that the guys I coach with think I'm a quiet, laid back, sort of humble guy. And I'm just tired by the time I get there. So I hang back and again, try to observe the behavior in those boys to make sure that the ones that seem like their confidence is shot have someone whispering in their ear going, "Don't you dare let your confidence fall. Get back in there now." So for me, that's a blast. And I, you know, will spend a good portion. That's a 5 day a week. I'm the guy up there in the booth. So
okay.
I get to pretend I'm a big shot coach every Saturday.
So how old are these kids?
12 years old. I'm the seventh grade team right now. Yeah.
Oh, well, good. Guess so. What's the record at this point?
We're 2-1. We beat the Walton Raiders on Saturday. That was a good feeling.
That's major stuff. That's major stuff. So what's the record been over the last couple of years?
Over the last couple of years? Actually, no, because we had just kindled up this feeder program at Lassiter. So it was just getting started. So we had a couple of brutal years where we had a losing team. We have two wonderful coaches right now who have done an amazing job helping us look less like incompetent coaches than we were a couple of years ago.
Very good. So, Keith, when you write that book, will it be a self-help book or a book about recipes or what exactly?
I think it's going to be a book about change and about the choices made in business and how there is not a guidebook for success. There's all kinds of books out there to say, if you do this and you do this and you do this, you'll succeed. And there are a lot of people who follow it right by the book and still fail. Mm-hmm. There's a book out there called The Lean Startup that's, you know, helped make the term pivoting so big these days. But I think that it, while it may become cliche, it's so true. I mean, you're constantly shifting, moving. There are a lot of sports analogies in there. So I think
Absolutely.
It'll just be a little bit of a story of life and change, and why not throw a couple recipes in there for people who enjoy a meal.
Ah, so it'll be kind of a dual, a kind of different thing,
the
right?
The first business book with recipes. New business model.
I like that. So now my final question for you, sir. Your answer to this question will be posted on our blog. So which business book has most impacted your leadership ability?
Wow. The most, it was the Kuzes and Posner book. Is it The Leadership Challenge?
The Leadership Challenge, yes.
That's the one, hands down. And because of the facilitation of Dr. Paul Lopez through that book, I mean, he opened the whole world to our own personal reflection over the course of the program. I mean, if that didn't make you look at yourself and how you behaved and what you did wrong and what you could do a little bit better, then there's not a book in America on the planet that will get you there. And it really hit home with me. It's one of those ones that I stick on the shelves on a regular basis. And then I like the younger Covey's The Speed of Trust. I think that's a phenomenal book as well.
Okay. Yeah, we've heard that that recommended as well.
Yep.
Okay, well, very good. So, Keith, on behalf of our learning community, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have you join us today to share your thoughts, expertise, and certainly your passion with us.
Thank you.
I'd love to have you back on a show in the future. Is that a deal?
It's a deal.
Get you back? Okay, good. So with that in mind, could you please let us know how our learning community can contact you, either by email or by phone?
Sure. Give me a call anytime at 678-701-7623. And for email inquiries, you can get me at keith@highroadcraft.com. That's HIGHROADCRAFT.
Well, fantastic. So with that response, we'll bring this edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. We invite you to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. Keith's interview will be there as well. So please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu if you have recommendations for guests. I'd certainly enjoy hearing your thoughts. So we're packing our boxes and moving to Tuesdays at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time at this same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.